From Redeemer Broadcasting, this is Holding All Things Together for the second weekend in December. I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Calvin Carter. For more than 50 years, the welfare state has waged war on marriage. Now, why do we say that? Well, for one reason, the welfare state is focused overwhelmingly on subsidizing single-parent families. And secondly, all welfare benefits are designed so that they are cut sharply when lower-income parents marry. As a consequence, nearly all lower-income parents are caught in a trap. They are faced with the perverse incentive of losing substantial economic resources if they tie the marital knot. This is not a godly solution. It is wrong, and it is hurting families. Mind you, married families are a most crucial structure in stable societies. This same welfare state also has the effect of causing crime to be on the rise. Joining us today is Robert Rector, Senior Research Fellow of the DeVos Center for Human Flourishing.
Well, let's go back. When Lyndon Johnson launched the War on Poverty, he said it was going to basically remove the causes of poverty. And since that time, we spent about $36 trillion on welfare and the War on Poverty. And the main effect of that was that when the War on Poverty began, 7% of children in the United States were born outside of marriage. Today, that number is 42%. And among blacks, it's closer to 70%. And this is the main cause of, say, crime in the inner city and so forth. Every social problem that you can think of is related to this removing of the fathers from the home.
Also ahead, Pastor Bill Shisco continues looking at Christ in the carols. This week, he considers the English carol, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Later in the program, writer Jerry Wiss considers one of the best-known Old Testament stories, the trickery of Laban in substituting Rachel, whom Jacob expected to marry, with Leah, Rachel's older sister, in Genesis 29. The covenant heir, Jacob, and the household of Laban have two separate destinies. Finally, we'll take another look at this week in history. All this just ahead on Holding All Things Together.
Well, as we look to Christmas, we're thinking about Christ in the carols. As you sing them, you should sing with your understanding, and I hope that this little series will help you with that. Here's my favorite Christmas carol, number 203, and at least in our hymnal, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Hark, which means listen, the herald angels, that means the preaching angels, and of course we're thinking about Luke 2:13 and 14, where there's a great company of the heavenly host praising God and saying, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men on whom his favor rests. Glory to the newborn king. Give all praise to Christ, who is the newborn king. Peace on earth. That's the great word that the angels bring. Good tidings of great joy, peace, which means peace with God. Through the work of Christ, God no longer angry with those who surrender to Christ. And the words mercy mild, when Jesus says he is gentle and lowly of heart, that's the meaning of that. Do you know Jesus as the gentle and lowly one who bids you to come to him? God and sinners reconciled. God himself is really reconciled by the work of the cross because of the atonement. He is no longer angry with those who surrender to him in faith. Joyful, all ye nations rise. That's missions. Join the triumph of the skies. Do you realize God has triumphed in his work in history? With angelic host proclaim, Christ is born in Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread, and he is the bread of life. And the last stanza of Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Hail the heaven-born Prince of Peace. Hail the Son of Righteousness. That picture of the rising sun is the picture of the Son of God who rises with healing in his wings. Light and life to all he brings, risen with healing in his wings, healing of soul, and also a body as well. Mild, gentle, he lays his glory by, born that man no more may die, everlasting life, born to raise the sons of earth, born to give them second birth. Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn king. Give him glory, not as the newborn king anymore, but as the reigning king.
On the Zoom line with us today is Robert Rector. He's from the Heritage Foundation. Robert, thank you so much for agreeing to come on today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Robert, I think about our situation here in America, and one of the big frustrations as a Christian is our welfare state. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to want to help people that are in need, and then out of my own resources, help them freely. It's another thing to take money from people and redistribute it to others and basically form a sort of slavery system that we call welfare. Maybe you can take it from that, and we'll start talking about this with respect to marriage.
Yes. Well, the problem with the welfare state is that it actually makes the poor people who get into it much worse off. And the way it does that is by, well, let's go back. When Lyndon Johnson launched the war on poverty, he said it was going to basically remove the causes of poverty. And since that time, we spent about $36 trillion on welfare and the war on poverty. And the main effect of that was that when the war on poverty began, 7% of children in the United States were born outside of marriage. Today, that number is 42%.
Oh, my.
And, yes. And among blacks, it's closer to 70%. And this is the main cause of, say, crime in the inner city and so forth. Every social problem that you can think of is related to this removing of the fathers from the home.
Yes.
And the principal cause behind that is the welfare state. It does this in a number of ways, but the simplest way that it does it is it actively punishes everyone in lower income and working income families, say those that make less than $80,000 a year. It's about 40% of the population. It actively and aggressively penalizes the mother and father if they do get married. Okay? It's an insane thing. People say and think that the welfare state penalizes work. It does that to a degree, but not to the way that it does with marriage. It actually, and let me give a clear example. And this is, there are over 90 different welfare programs. We spend $1.6 trillion a year on these programs, about half of it going to families with kids. All of those programs aggressively penalize parents if they get married. So if you had, say, a father that makes $30,000 a year and a mother that makes $20,000 a year, this is right in the heart of the welfare system at that income level. They have a joint income of $50,000. But if they get married, they will lose $15,000 of those benefits. So there's a marriage penalty of about 30% of their income right off the bat. And if the mother is in Section 8 housing, the penalty will be close to $27,000. Nearly half of their income is taken away. And so we've made, for all low-income families, we've made it so that you actually lose money if you get married. People think that the welfare state that does that against work, too, but it actually doesn't. It almost never does it against work. But in every single one of these programs, it aggressively penalizes marriage. And the way to think about this is if you had an income tax code where you didn't have the category married filing jointly, okay, so that when the couple's incomes get together and they get added together, that you go in a much higher tax bracket. That's what welfare does, but it does it like on steroids. And so what is very typical is that if the mother is potentially eligible and can get benefits from things like Medicaid or housing or food stamps or something like that, as long as she does not have the husband in the home or hides the father, she can get all those benefits. The minute the working father's income comes in and she marries him, his income is counted and she loses eligibility for almost all of those programs. And the middle class doesn't understand this. Politicians don't understand it. Low-income people understand this perfectly. Mm-hmm. They understand that basically society is saying to them, don't get married. You're a chump if you get married. And this is a reason that we've created a whole culture against marriage in low-income communities that's often being resisted by the low-income people themselves. Let me give you a clear statistic of this. As we speak this year or last year, 1 in 4 children were born to outside of marriage, but with parents who were cohabiting at the time the child was born. They were living together, and they had been living together for several years, and they're likely to continue to live together, unmarried, for several years. Why are they doing that? Okay, because they clearly have an interest in maintaining a relationship with each other and with the child, but they're not getting married. And the reason for that they understand and no one else does, is they will lose tens of thousands of dollars if they get married. And so they cohabit and they hide the father's presence in the home from the welfare state and things like that. But that's a very unstable situation. You want them to make the commitment of marriage. You want them to have the same rights, the same upward aspiration that everyone else does.
Yes.
And this is the number one best thing you can do for the child, for the father and for the mother, is to get them together in a stable united marriage. But the welfare state and our government is adamantly against that. You have the radical left that's actually hostile to marriage. The rest of the welfare state is just completely indifferent to it as an antiquated medieval institution, and they are making the world safe for single parenthood. This is an old, old objective of the radical left. When we think Marx wanted to do away with private property.
Yeah.
Marx and Engels also wanted to do away with marriage. Engels wrote an entire book about this, that in order to get into utopia, you have to destroy the institution of marriage, have children raised by the government, and then the adults could just fool around in various amorous relationships going from one to another. It's a hedonistic, insane vision of what you want society to be. But that is the vision that the left has. I'm not saying everyone that is in runs the welfare state has that vision. The rest of them just want to redistribute income and flatten things, and they don't care about the actual behavioral effects of what they're doing. But it's a disaster for the poor. And what we need to do is change this system. There are over 90 of these programs. All of them have these aggressive anti-marriage penalties, and we need to pull that back and stop providing as excessive benefits we have. We provide very, very heavy benefits to single mothers that can go as high as $60,000 a year in joint benefits on top of any earnings that she has, and pull those back. We have massive fraud in all of these programs. Let's get rid of the fraud and use at least part of the savings that we get from that to provide better benefits for these parents when they do make the right choice and they do get married, the choice that's in the best interest of themselves and of the children. It's the marriage is the number one factor in helping children have upward mobility.
Yeah.
And the other victim class of this in particular are men. The welfare state has driven an entire class of men outside of the family. They are not breadwinners. They're not husbands. And they have very little reason to exist. They don't know what the point of their life is because you rob them of their basic role.
Yeah.
And you know what group that is? Those are people that die from fentanyl overdoses. Okay. The group that dies from fentanyl overdoses are single, unmarried men who have a high school degree or less. And they are out of the family. They have no role. They have no purpose in life. They OD. They die because the welfare state robbed them of their role in society and their role in life.
Well put. This is, you've said a mouthful, and I really appreciate it. It reminds me of an interview I did years ago with someone that was talking about Newburgh, New York, and the crime rate is very high there. It's through the roof. And I was asking why, and the reason that he gave me is because the fathers are leaving the home, and the wife is left to fend for herself. And this is the system that encourages that sort of thing.
Well, in very low-income communities, you've essentially eliminated marriage through this system. We've been doing it for 50 years. And when you eliminate marriage, as boys are growing up in that system, the nature abhors a vacuum. So they do not have role models in front of them of fathers, of husbands that are working and supporting families. They're going to drift to other role models. Those role models are usually antisocial, self-destructive, and violent.
Yes.
And what you end up with in the worst situation, in the very high crime rates in the inner city, there are no married families in there. And those are young men that are growing up and being socialized by gangs gang violence.
I knew of a kid in prison, and he referred to the fellows in prison as my boys. And so there's this bind to the gangs. And it's very evil. Robert Rector is our guest today. Robert, if someone wants to read more, maybe contact you, how would they go about doing that?
You could just Google my name up, Robert Rector, R-E-C-T-O-R, and look for something about welfare and marriage penalties or anything. I've written about welfare in the welfare state for about 40 years, so I'm pretty easy to find.
May God bless your work. Robert Rector is Senior Research Fellow, Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Human Flourishing at Heritage. Robert, God bless you, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
This week, Jerry shows us how Jacob makes his way to Haran, where providentially he meets his future wife at the community well. After he identifies himself, she runs home to tell her father Laban, who likewise runs back to the well to welcome Jacob. So far, so good. Laban offers Jacob's wages for work, but Jacob, therefore a wife, names Rachel as his compensation, after working 7 years for Laban. How Laban answers is taken one way by Jacob, but is likely intended another way by Laban, which we'll soon discover. There is a bond, but also a rivalry between the two. Laban, not Jacob, is in pole position, but as we follow the covenant heir over the years, even through his difficulties with his uncle, we uncover how God reverses the two's positions. Jerry is a frequent contributor to Holding All Things Together and is a writer for Christian Renewal magazine.
The deceiver deceived. That's what we see in Genesis 29 with Jacob promised that Rachel will be given to him for his wife after working for his uncle Laban for 7 years. Jacob the trickster is himself tricked. And as we saw last time we were in Genesis, a rivalry develops between the two that involves deception and sleight of hand. The Lord delivers to Jacob a dose of his own medicine. That, of course, does not let Laban off the hook. It's a well-known story. Jacob, after 7 years of working for Laban, comes to his uncle for Rachel's hand. A wedding feast is held, but Laban pulls a switch after the ceremony so that Leah, not Rachel, goes into Jacob for the night. Verse 25 says it all. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. We saw it last time how Laban's response to Jacob about giving Rachel to him after 7 years' labor is ambiguous. It is better that I give her to you than I should give her to any other man, Laban tells Jacob in verse 19. And of course, Laban does give Rachel's hand to Jacob, but not before surreptitiously arranging for Leah, his firstborn, to be the first in the bridal bower. Laban then gives Rachel to Jacob, with the covenant heir getting corralled into another 7 years of working for Laban. So he did give Rachel away, as promised, but not as expected. This is technical truth-telling, which of course is not truthful at all. Christians can also fall into this way of behavior when they promise something and even deliver on the promise, technically speaking, but only after they get what they want. It's not an example of neighbor love, though it proposes itself to be such, but really is a form of manipulation, and in this case, clearly a swindle. Laban gets what he wants, namely unloading his older, homely daughter and getting another 7 years of work out of the covenant heir. The apostle provides a list of sinful behaviors, characteristics of unrighteousness, in 1 Corinthians 6 that assures the early Christians that people who live this way shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Making the list are the greedy and swindlers or confidence men, people who show they mean others well or that they want the best for them while actually arranging for their victims' fleecing to their own advantage. Laban, in at least this instance, fits the bill. Jacob, understandably, is angry and confronts Laban. But Laban does not lean on his technical truth-telling. When Jacob heatedly asks, "Why have you deceived me?" Laban does not deny the deception. He just appeals to tradition. We've always done things this way. He tells Jacob in verse 26, "It is not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn." Of course, this is something Laban should have told Jacob 7 years ago when Jacob first sought the hand of Rachel. But Jacob loved Rachel, we read several times in Genesis 29, and so he agrees to work for Laban another 7 years. With this, Laban then also gives Rachel to Jacob, who now has two wives. And when we see polygamy in the Old Testament, we remember that the people of God did not yet have fully disclosed revelation. The Lord Jesus in Matthew 19, though speaking about divorce and not a multiplicity of wives, affirms the sanctity of marriage between one man and one woman. We will see with Jacob, as we see with David, that a multiplicity of wives and concubines, especially after children are born, leads to disorder and even anarchy and violence. In Jacob's case, partiality also gets mixed into this brew, which brings on further antagonism. We'll see that Jacob is far from a perfect man, but because he is the covenant heir, even his sins, which result in pain and frustration, are recycled into future blessing. That's never an excuse to sin, but it's a great assurance of God's mercy and kindness when we do, which leads to further maturity in grace.
Time once again for This Week in History. December 7th, 1941. A little before 8 a.m. Hawaii time, 360 Japanese warplanes bearing the rising sun of Japan on their wings appear overhead, then launch a surprise attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. The attack is a critical blow against the U.S. Pacific Fleet and draws the United States irrevocably into World War II. By the end of the attack, 5 battleships, 3 destroyers, and 7 other ships are sunk or severely damaged, and more than 200 aircraft are destroyed. A total of 2,400 Americans die in the attack, and 1,200 more are wounded. As President Roosevelt will say to a joint session of Congress, "It is a day that will live in infamy." And December 10, 1974. Democratic Representative Wilbur D. Mills from Arkansas resigns as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee as facts of what is considered the first truly public sex scandal in American politics come to light. In October, Mills was stopped by park police while driving at night with his lights off. The 65-year-old married man was drunk and with him in the car was 38-year-old stripper Annabelle Bastitella, who jumped into the tidal basin near the Jefferson Memorial to escape and was pulled out by the police. She was later identified as a popular stripper who went by the names Fanny Fox and the Argentine Firecracker. That was This Week in History, events as man recorded them, as God ordained them.
That's our program for this week. Thanks for joining us. Holding All Things Together is a production of Redeemer Broadcasting, and the views expressed are those of the participants. If you'd like to support us and help on production and distribution expenses, you may visit our website and give in a secure fashion online. We're found at RedeemerBroadcasting.org. For Holding All Things Together, I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Calvin Carter.
God willing, see you next week.